Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Paul Kubitschek, a professor of political science at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. He graduated with a PhD from the University of Michigan back in 1995 and spent 3 years teaching at Koç University in Istanbul, Turkey, and also was a Fulbright Scholar in Slovenia. Early in his career, he specialized in post-communist politics and the European Union, and has written and/or edited several books including Unbroken Ties, The State, Interest Associations, and Corporatism in Post-Soviet Ukraine, The European Union and Democratization, From Solidarity to Infirmity, Organized Labor in Post-Communist States, and most recently, Political Islam and Democracy in the Muslim World. Given the nature of our program, which is about religion and not post-communist labor organization, we'll be focusing on this last book. His perspective as an American who taught in Turkey and who didn't necessarily set out to study religion and politics early in his career provides a unique perspective to the question of Islam and democracy. As always, links to our guest books can be found on our website as well as podcasts related to today's theme, so please check it out. Paul, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. My pleasure in joining you.
You have a very interesting career trajectory, which is something that you note in the preface of your new book, Political Islam and Democracy in the Muslim World. Your first post-PhD job was at Koç University, which is set up in the hills surrounding the Black Sea, just north of Istanbul. And you weren't even a scholar of Turkey, per se. How did this come about, and how did this influence the writing of your most recent book?
Well, it's a long story. I guess I would just say this was in 1995, and I finished my PhD, and I applied for a variety of jobs and places that I thought looked interesting. Koç University advertised, and I applied for the job. I didn't really think much of it. I had never been to Turkey before. I had done my research and work on Ukraine and Russia and Eastern Europe. And the day I defended my dissertation, I actually got a call from Istanbul inviting me to go out for a job interview. So I went out the following week, and it was not located then in the hills overlooking Istanbul. It was in an old match factory in Istinye, along the waterfront there, away from the water. And it seemed a reasonable place, and I was up for the adventure, so I signed on for a 3-year gig there at Koç. And that's where it all, I suppose, started. I learned Turkish, and I quickly found that many of the issues that Turkey was struggling with related to nationalism, ethnic conflict, democratization, expansion of civil political rights, institutional reforms, these were similar in some respects to what I'd studied before, and not many people were studying Turkey. It kind of fallen between the cracks of Europe and the Middle East. And so I started doing some work on Turkey, initially on Kurdish issues, some on the European Union, and it kind of spiraled. And always in the back of my mind, of course, was this question of Islam and Turkey standing out as, at the time anyway, the one Muslim-majority democratic country, an imperfect democracy to be sure, but nonetheless has this credential. And since then, I've continued, you know, studying it, different aspects of it, you know, now for over 20 years.
I have to admit that you're taking a job at Koç University and not knowing Turkish at the time or never having visited Istanbul before doing the job interview is pretty courageous. Was there any trepidation there saying, well, I'm going out to a country, I don't know the language, but I'm going to be at a university teaching there? And Koç teaches in English a lot, is that correct?
Yeah, Koç teaches all in English. I had lived and did my dissertation work in Ukraine, which in the early 1990s was exceptionally challenging. So everything from there was sort of a step up in some respects. And the language, it was intimidating. Istanbul is a big city that was intimidating, but it was a very collegial environment. They had many foreigners teaching there. The Turkish colleagues were wonderful as well. It was a really great experience, I would say. I was young at the time, and I said, up for adventures. I've gone back to Turkey, obviously, several times since then. It was a great thing. No questions about it, and I kind of look back on it amazed that I did that, because, as you say, it is something to kind of, leap into the deep end of the pool, so to speak, but it was great.
Yeah, I have to mention that in the introduction, I noted that Koch University was located in the hills up by the Black Sea, and the reason I know that is that I was invited to give a few talks out there several years back, and they asked me, well, when do you want to come out? And my image of Turkey is that, it's on the Mediterranean Sea, beautiful blue ocean, and you got the nice beaches, it's going to be really warm, and so, I want to get out of the cold, wet of Seattle during the winter months, and so, I'll come out in January. And when I was out there, they had a foot and a half of snow, which I was not prepared for. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is kind of crazy. And the other thing was that in order to get back to the airport during the snowstorm or shortly after the snowstorm, they had to call a cab out. And the guy who picked me up obviously spoke Turkish. He didn't speak English. I didn't speak any Turkish. And it was a pretty long drive down these winding hills with snow all over the place. And I was just absolutely terrified. It was one of the most terrifying moments of my life. So.
Yeah, he probably didn't have a lot of practice driving in the snow. So
no.
Probably part of it, yeah.
So, very interesting. But it is interesting. One of the things that you learn when you go to countries that you haven't been to before where you don't know the language is you tend to be a stranger in a strange land and notice things that a lot of people normally would not. I know this from my experience living in South America. Was there anything that you noticed differently, that you got this view of the Muslim world that challenged some of your stereotypes or that other people in the country didn't notice?
Well, Koch was a very secular institution, and most of the people I had contact with were secular oriented. But then when you went out into the city or even in other parts of Turkey, of course, you realized really how diverse it was, and there's everything in Turkey. You can find anything you want there, and it's for tourists it's great, for social scientists it's great. And so I think I was really struck by the diversity of the place, and trying to fit it into a particular category. And I kind of write about this in the book as well. Islam is it's not a single category. There's diverse aspects of Islam. There's diverse aspects within each and every sort of country, and kind of seeing how that the politics and things played out in Turkey among the different groups, among different social classes, among different regions. That to me has been really interesting, the divisions within Turkey.
Well, let's start talking about Islam and political Islam and democracy in your new book, and get to an empirical lay of the land, so to speak. You are picking up on a puzzle that a number of other scholars are addressing, and that's the lack of representative forms of government in countries that have predominantly Muslim populations. And when I say Muslim populations, this usually gets people thinking about countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Syria. But we should note that the Muslim world actually does spread from Morocco on the west coast of Africa all the way out into Asia and Malaysia. What is the nature of this democratic deficit in the Muslim world, as some have called it?
Well, if you look at common measures of democracy or freedom, and we can talk about what democracy be defined as, but well-known data sets that measure countries comparatively on the extent of democracy or extent of respect for political rights and civil liberties, Muslim-majority countries score remarkably low. And I'll just give you like a sort of statistic here that I think really drives it home. The Polity data set, which purports to measure democracy across countries on a scale of negative 10 to 10, with positive 10 meaning you're fully democratic, the average score of a Muslim majority country is negative 0.36. The average score of all other countries in the world is 5.55. I mean, there's a yawning chasm between Muslim majority states and all other states, and only 12 out of the 46 Muslim majority countries, judged by Polity, as of 2012, could meet the minimal scores of democracy, which means like about 25%, whereas most other countries, you're talking about 70% of countries as measured by polity would be democratic. So there's a big gap and difference here. Islam, democracy can be found in the Muslim world. My book examined several cases, but it's relatively rare compared to non-Muslim countries.
We're going to get into some of those cases a little bit later on, but I think we should start off by defining the term democracy. It seems one of these terms that, well, everybody knows what democracy is, but it has a lot of different facets to it, and different scholars perhaps approach it in different ways. So with respect to your book and the work that you're doing and perhaps the Polity data set, what does democracy look like? If I saw it walking down the street, how would I know a democracy?
Well, there's levels of democracy, I suppose, and sort of like what the minimum threshold is and sort of full respect or full-on democracy. And the minimal threshold would be that you need to have a competitive political system in which you have elections, leaders are chosen by the people, the actual rulers of the country are those chosen by the people, so you can't have a military or an unelected monarch or something that actually is the real power broker in a country. The elections need to be competitive so that people have a meaningful choice among parties or candidates. And there needs to be sufficient respect of political rights so that candidates and parties can organize, get their message out, and make the electoral process fair. Now, on top of that, most indices of democracy would include respect for civil liberties and political rights, individual rights, whether that be freedom of speech, whether that be freedom of assembly. Freedom House, which I also use, talks about rule of law. It talks about minority rights, whether that be ethnic minority rights, religious minority rights, women's rights. So there's a whole host of things you can add on to democracy to sort of flesh it out, the core being the competitive electoral system. But even if you just sort of minimize it down to that basis, again, you would find very few countries in the Muslim world that have competitive, free, and fair elections.
Okay, yeah, that was going to be my next question, is to what extent or to what dimensions are the Muslim countries suffering on here in terms of that? And you said it's mostly competitive elections, the same with civil liberties and minority rights and such?
Well, every country has problems every country in the world, for that matter, has problems with minority rights or civil rights or whatever. I mean, this is relatively common. In the Muslim world, most countries don't even meet the minimal threshold of having competitive, free, and fair elections. Mm-hmm. Even those then that do have competitive elections, Turkey, for example, would be a case in point, you have severe problems on the political rights or civil liberties perspective, so that, for example, Freedom House ranks Turkey as partially free. Bangladesh is also rated as partially free. There's very few countries that Freedom House, which takes this more liberal rights-oriented view of democracy, would rank as free. As best I know, as of 2014, for Freedom House, the only Muslim-majority states that rank as free, according to Freedom House, would be Senegal, Indonesia, and now Tunisia.
And those are countries that we're going to talk about here in a minute, especially Senegal, you find to be a very interesting case. But we have this set of countries, predominantly Muslim populations, that are scoring well below most other countries when it comes to democratic measurements in the Polity data set. So people have been looking at this. They're saying, this is a puzzle. What's going on here? What have been some of the previous explanations for this so-called democratic deficit?
Well, there's a big literature on democratization, what fosters it, what undermines existing democracies. And so people will talk about the fact that Muslim-majority states maybe, lack sufficient socioeconomic development, for example, would be one area that people would focus on. So if you tend to be poor, you're less likely to be democratic. Some would focus on imperialism or colonial legacies and say that, post-colonial states have had problems democratizing, and most Muslim-majority states qualify as post-colonial states, and this would be an explanation. Some would find the locus in U.S. policy, particularly in the Middle East, to say the U.S. has not been sincere in promoting democracy in the Muslim world, has other priorities, access to oil or stability. So the U.S. has not been a good actor in promoting democracy, as it may be in some other areas of the world. Some have focused on the resource curse and talked about over-reliance on oil and gas exports in particular as creating corruption and undermining democratic politics. Again, this applies better perhaps to the Middle East, but not only to the Middle East, to any oil-exporting country. Some have also written on lack of respect for women's rights, and that therefore undermines democracy. But that can tie into very easily into the cultural religious explanation that Islam has something to do with it. And indeed, in statistical analysis, if you were to control for level of economic development, oil and gas exports, extent of globalization, colonial experience, you would still find that Islam comes out as statistically significant in a large N study as being a factor negatively associated with democracy. Now, I'm not focusing on a large N type approach here, but Islam does sort of stand out. And so what the purpose of my book was to look at the cases where you do see democratic experience in the Muslim world and see what role, if any, Islam plays in those countries.
I want to back you up a little bit on some of these explanations because some of our listeners might not be all that familiar with them. One that you mentioned is the issue of socioeconomic development and that poor nations tend to be less democratic. And this might shock some folks because the very simple stereotype of a Muslim country might be Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. And it just seems like money is raining from the sky because of oil revenues there. And another thing that you mentioned too is this thing about the resource curse is that, well, wait a minute, if you're blessed with lots of oil in the ground and everybody in the world wants oil and you can basically suck it out of the ground in the big straw and money will rain all over the place. That should seem good for political development. Everybody's happy because money is raining all over the place. Address that a little bit because there is some misperception that everybody in the Muslim world or even the oil states are wealthy.
Well, there's a lot of diversity in the Muslim world in terms of socioeconomic development. And again, as you noted, the Muslim world really stretches from Morocco to Malaysia. So you're not just talking about Arab countries in the Middle East. You're talking about countries in West Africa like Senegal and Mali. You're talking about South Asian states like Bangladesh, very poor. A country like Malaysia, a middle-income country, one might say. Pakistan, I include my study, another poor country. So you see a lot of diversity there. And actually, this is an interesting finding, actually among Muslim states, the richer countries tend to be less democratic than the poorer ones, which is the exact opposite of what you would find overall, with the universal sample of all countries. And that reflects the fact that your rich oil and gas producers, the Saudi Arabias, the Kuwaits, the Qatars, the Bahrains, are undemocratic. And again, the resource curse would be cited here as the primary sort of explanation, which is simply that if you don't have strong democratic institutions or well-functioning institutions, and you discover oil and gas, in a nutshell, the oil and gas is going to create a corruption and privilege very few actors, create rent-seeking behavior among elites, and it's going to stifle democratic development. I mean, Norway is an oil producer and is democratic. Canada is an oil producer and is democratic, but it had the democracy before it had significant oil and gas development. If oil and gas development comes first before democracy, you're really unlikely to democratize.
Yeah, if you end up with lots of riches from oil, you don't have to really worry about the population too much. You just pour it into your bank accounts and everything's good.
Right.
Yeah. So that brings us to these explanations dealing with culture. And it could be political culture, it could be religious culture, it could be political and religious culture. What have other scholars been saying with respect to how Islam is not congruent with democracy?
Well, this is a real minefield, right? And there's a lot of very polarized arguments on this. But on the side of those who would say that Islam presents a barrier to democracy, various arguments are in vogue. One of the most popular ones is that Islam, by a pious Muslim, perhaps, by saying that God is sovereign over all things, that person would deny the possibility of sovereign representative government of people making a choice on how to rule themselves, because the argument would be God has already told you in the Quran and in other holy texts how you should live, how government should be organized, and you really don't need to have voting or any sort of democracy. In other words, God rules, people don't rule, and you should just follow what God says. And on some level, perhaps you could argue this is what, you know, Saudi Arabia has, to the extent that they would say the Quran is their constitution. And that's the interpretation of Islam they would hold to. Other aspects of Islam that may conflict with democracy involve with adoption of Sharia law, which may, again, not be democratic in the sense that it is God-given law as opposed to human-made law, or it may violate the rights of minorities, whether it be non-Muslims, whether it be non-practicing Muslims, whether it be women. Women's rights are obviously a big concern in many states as something that Islam arguably works against. So you have issues, again, you know, relating to popular sovereignty. You have issues of restrictions on personal freedoms or freedom of speech, for example, blasphemy laws, or prohibitions against certain types of political parties that may violate religious or otherwise cultural norms in a given situation, and Islam would be invoked to defend that. You'll see laws against blasphemy or laws against inciting religious hatred or restrictions on rights on certain minorities in various Muslim states. So there's a wide range of things that Islam could do, doesn't always do, that could do, could play a role in inhibiting democracy, particularly, I would say, a liberal type of democracy that really espouses individual rights and freedom.
Now, one of the things that you noted earlier is that in the Muslim world, there's a lot of variety. You saw this in Turkey. You can see this in a number of other countries that from the outside, Westerners might see as rather homogenous, but really there's a great deal of pluralism within these nations. And that brings up the issue of Islam versus political Islam. And political Islam is in your title. Give us a sense of what the difference between Islam and political Islam is, or more specifically, just kind of define what you mean by political Islam.
Well, the way I'm using it would be the following. I mean, Islam, you know, has a history. It goes back to the time of Muhammad, and obviously it's a theology. It tells you about the nature of God, the nature of the universe, and has prescriptions about how humans should behave vis-a-vis both God and vis-a-vis in their community, right? Political Islam, I would say, is when Islam is used by political actors as a discourse, as an ideology, as a platform to promote an agenda in which Islam is incorporated somehow into the body politic, into the state's legal system, so that it assumes a political meaning above and beyond any sort of personal meaning it may have for a pious believer. And even though one may, you know, believe that, you know, today political Islam seems, you know, omnipresent in the Muslim world, this hasn't always been the case. In many countries, traditionally anyway, Islam had a very light political role. It may have been incorporated into the legal system, that is true, but it wasn't politicized and used as a means to mobilize people to win votes or to demonize or repress one's opponents. So, you know, we can talk about some of these cases, for example, but you've seen a real upsurge in Islamic-oriented activity in countries, for example, like Mali or Senegal or even Turkey, for that matter, where you really didn't see that three, four decades ago.
So you're dating this phenomena back about three decades. Is that correct?
I would date it back, yeah, about to the Iranian Revolution, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe a little prior to that.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and talk about this in terms of your case studies, because the strength of your book is to actually dig deep into some of these countries, including Turkey, where you spent some time and started the ideas gestating here, and talk about some of the successes with democracy, which blows away some of the stereotypes. We think of Muslim society as being rigidly authoritarian, but that's not necessarily the case. And then also some of the struggles that they might be having with moving towards full democratization and what political Islam has to play in that kind of role. So let's go ahead and start with Turkey. That's where you spent some time, 3 years living and teaching. Tell us a little bit about Turkey's struggle with democratization and where it is now.
Well, if any conversation you have with modern Turkey, you obviously have to start with Atatürk, the founder of the Republic of Turkey in the 1920s, 1923 to be exact. He created a very secular state based upon the French laïcité model, in which religion would be taken out of the public sector, essentially, and the state even has a directorate of religious affairs that monitors and sort of decides what sort of Islam it wants to present. The state, if you will, controls religion. Religion is put under the state, and religion is essentially not supposed to be in the public sphere. Well, it was initially a one-party state until after World War II, when Turkey began to democratize, but it did so, and so Turkey has the most extensive, longest experience of democracy in the Muslim world, which dates back to 1946, when they first had competitive multi-party elections. And in fact, in 1950, the opposition party won. And Turkey's had its ups and downs of democracy since then, the downs most often associated with military coups, not with political Islam. The military is a bastion of secularism and would, come in to restore stability if it thought that the society is becoming too polarized and there was other sort of problem in it. The initial democratization in Turkey in the 1940s really was not, Islam did not play a substantial role. It was sort of an intra-elite split from the ruling party into an opposition. There was now an opposition party was allowed. The opposition won elections. And Islam was used in a very modest cultural sort of way by some political parties to give their bona fides that they were more with the common people. A common thing that Turkey did in the 1950s, for example, proposals were to increase religious education in the school and to restore the call to prayer in Turkey back to Arabic, which previously had been in Turkish. But we're not talking about adoption of Islamic law or, declaration of Islam as the official religion or anything like that. Since the 1970s, I would say, you have seen political Islam mobilize in Turkey in various forms, usually with a minority viewpoint. Parties that explicitly use Islamic symbols gathering 15 to 20% of the vote. These parties have periodically been banned. Under Turkish law, you're not allowed to do that or to advocate adoption of Islamic law. So you've seen, political Islam begin to manifest itself. And the most current party, the ruling party in Turkey, the AKP, the Justice and Development Party, came out of that political Islamic movement, but they claim to be conservative Democrats. And they do not explicitly, or at least until recently, do not explicitly refer to Islam or Islamic symbols, and certainly do not call for adoption of Sharia law, which would have a minority support among all Turks. But it becomes difficult for me as an outsider anyway, and I think for secular Turks as well, to understand what conservative means in a society in which conservative values would all be associated with Islam. So when the Turkish leader says we are conservative and we represent conservative positions, typically that would be synonymous with what Islam would, or at least some interpretations of Islam would prescribe, whether that be bans on alcohol or limits on alcohol, whether that be sexual mores, whether that be the position of women in society, whether that be co-ed student housing, or any number of disputes that have occurred recently in Turkey.
So one of the things that Turkey did, and I'm going to challenge you here with this question, was that it removes religion out of the political landscape back in the Atatürk days and then throughout most of the 20th century, and then comes back to it. So religion tends to be sidelined. And nowadays, the democracy movement, and back a couple decades ago, was fighting for more religious rights, saying, religious rights are being denied to us. We can't open our own mosques. Our women can't wear a headscarf if they so choose. Is that kind of a good model for the rest of the Muslim world, thinking that, well, what you have to do first is just tamp down religion, and then we'll come back to it later? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think some Turks would argue that's the case. But I think many Turks now recognize that in the modern world now, given the global resurgence of Islam, that it would be counterproductive to just per se try to repress religion or expunge it from the public sphere. So, for example, in Turkey, a big debate has been over the role of the headscarf in public institutions, which until recently a pious Muslim woman who was a university student or a public employee could not wear the headscarf. We're not talking about the burqa, we're just talking about a head covering. If she was attending classes at a university or working in a state bank or working in a government office. And this was defended by secular Turks as, you know, we have to do this, otherwise if we allow this, we'll just be a tidal wave. Suddenly everybody will cover and will become Iran. This is sort of apocalyptic vision, right? The law has been changed in the last 5 years now, so that students can wear headscarves and female employees in the state sector can now wear headscarves. Even female parliamentarians can wear headscarves. In 1990, you had a woman kicked out of parliament, stripped of her parliamentary mandate because she covered in parliament. So, and the consensus, I think, in Turkey has been, the opposition has sort of died away, is that, well, this is a liberal right. We're giving people rights and we're giving people freedom. If they want to express their religion, the state's not going to prevent them from doing that in this sort of way. What becomes trickier, of course, is when religion is used by political parties or certain public figures to say, we are mandating that everybody do this in the name of religion, or we're setting up this law in the name of religion, not to expand freedoms, but to dictate what the proper public morality would be. And that's where you've seen real backlash in Turkey against the so-called conservative, or if you prefer, the Islamic agenda of the government.
And so what is happening there today? Some people are talking about there might be a bit of backsliding in terms of Turkey's democratization. Things were looking pretty hunky-dory 10, 15, 20 years ago, but now everybody's starting to get a little bit concerned. What's going on now?
Well, you've had a number of problems, ranging from most particularly arrests of journalists who've been critical of the government, clampdowns or interference of the state in the media, telling self-censorship of media or telling media outlets what to cover, periodic shutdowns of internet, social media sites like YouTube or Twitter. You've had investigations into companies that have been critical of the government. You know, the tax police have been brought out to work against opponents. You've had clampdowns on Kurdish activists in Turkey. You've had more polarizing discourse by some Turkish leaders against minorities. The Alevi minority in Turkey, which is a non-Sunni Islamic sect there, statements against, you know, the Jews or Armenians or other minorities, you know, the West in general. It would be hard, though, and I would be cautious about blaming all of this, or most of it for that matter, on Islam. I think that the simplest explanation, if you will, is that the government has acquired, until the recent elections, has acquired enough power that the typical checks on power in the Turkish system, whether it be the constitutional court, whether it be the military, obviously the electorate, that with majority support and unencumbered by any sort of check on their power, the government has felt freer to pursue an agenda that is less than tolerant, shall we say, of critics, regardless of where these critics may come from. To say that is somehow inspired by Islam, to me, seems a stretch. I mean, you see something similar happening in Russia, and certainly Putin is no Islamist. So, you know, I don't know if you necessarily need to, or it makes sense to invoke Islam and say that's what's driving developments in Turkey.
Yeah, no, governments tend to do that, we see over time. Once you get power, you like to have more power and not to have that challenge. So that is not necessarily an Islamist thing. One of the things that I want to ask about Turkey is its unique position straddling the two shores of the Bosphorus. It's both in Asia / the Middle East, and then it's also looking toward Europe. And you've done a great deal of work on the European Union. Is there a tug from Europe and a concern within Turkey to be part of Europe that is putting the brakes on a lot of the movement of political Islam taking over the government or anything? Is there some kind of mediating effect that might be helping with democratization there, or how do you see that?
A decade ago, Europe had a very positive influence on a series of political reforms that was undertaken by the current Turkish government, the AKP government, which, you know, the economists will label, you know, mildly Islamist or something like this. Europe had a very positive influence in pushing through, you know, dozens of constitutional amendments to expand freedoms, to curtail the power of the military, to end the death penalty in Turkey. So you really had a much more liberal, freer environment in Turkey. One of the remarkable reforms in the 1990s, in the 2000s, with the influence of the European Union, was broadcasting and political campaigning in Kurdish is now allowed, which has been unthinkable when I first went to Turkey in 1995. That influence has subsided. Turkey, you know, jumped at the chance to join the EU. As the talks with the EU is stalled and membership seems further and further away, as European politicians such as Angela Merkel of Germany have spoke negatively about Turkish membership, the idea that Turkey can make reforms and join the EU seems at best a distant possibility. And so the reform momentum has really subsided. The Turkish government has, the current Turkish president, President Erdogan, has stated in, you know, as recently as 2011, 2012, that, you know, Europe will criticize us, but, you know, we're going to go our own way and do our own thing. The European Union has its own problems today and seems less attractive, perhaps, as well. And I think Turkey, particularly starting around 2010, 2011, believed it could do better going alone, tried to expand ties to the Middle East, thought it could play a more positive role in that region. The Arab Spring was a big victory in some ways for Erdogan. Turkey was seen as a model for other Middle Eastern countries. So you had this real confidence, I think, that Turkey had, and that bolstered Erdogan or the government's standing at home as well. That's changed. I mean, the war in Syria, Turks are highly concerned about that. Turkish foreign policy is in tatters. The corruption scandals and other problems of the current government, you saw in the most recent elections, it did receive over 40% of the vote, but this was almost 10% less than it had in 2011. So you're seeing real change in Turkey, and it might be, I mean, I'm keeping a close eye on it, and I think other, you know, people should as well, it might be moving back to more of a normal situation of coalition government, and the reform momentum, whether it be from Europe or just within, you know, domestic politics, may pick up again. So I remain cautiously optimistic there.
Well, we will keep looking at that one. And you have several other cases in your book that you examine outside of the stereotype of the Muslim world being in the Middle East. And one of the most interesting cases that you talk about is Senegal, and that's in Africa. What is happening in Senegal? I think most folks don't even know where Senegal is on a map. So give us an idea of its political history and where it's at now.
Well, Senegal is a former French colony in West Africa, along the Atlantic Ocean. It became independent in 1960, and it joined the ranks of democracies, meaning it democratized, and you saw a change in government. Opposition came to power in 2000, and so it has, for the last 15 years, remained a fairly vibrant democracy there. And prior to 2000, it sort of was what some observers would call a semi-democratic state, where you had limited political freedoms, but it was essentially rigged so the government would win every election. What's interesting about Senegal, several things. It's 95% Muslim, but the majority of Senegalese belong to Sufi brotherhoods. And there's a variety of Sufi brotherhoods, some homegrown, indigenous, some influenced by North Africa Sufi groups existing in Senegal. So you have a real religious marketplace there. And the leaders of these Sufi brotherhoods have exercised a lot of social and political clout, especially in the countryside, as Senegal remains mostly, you know, a rural country. But they never really advanced an Islamic agenda or an Islamist agenda, campaigning for Islamic law or anything like this. Senegal is a secular state based on the French laïcité model. Its first president was a Catholic. Only in 2000 was its first lady a Muslim, meaning that its other presidents were Muslims but had married Christians. And it's been a real tolerant place. It hasn't seen intercommunal violence. and has not seen Islam really insert itself into the political realm in a in an aggressive way, demanding certainly restrictions of rights or threatening the status quo in a way, inducing violence or terror or anything that one might associate, you know, stereotypes from the Middle East. So I would say it's been very successful this way. As a secular state, people are religious. The religious groups do lobby for certain policies that they're interested in. For example, changes in family law has been an issue there, in particular about recognizing religious marriages, that the state should recognize these and it doesn't have to go through the state. But it hasn't played an aggressive sort of role in the country at all. And again, the country democratized, by and large, before you saw any sort of wave of Islamic political oriented activity. But those who study Senegal closely will talk about tolerance, a syncretic model where Islam came later to West Africa and blended in with religious indigenous traditions. And a lot of Senegalese will look upon what's happening in the Middle East and efforts to import that version of Islam into their country and say, that's not our Islam, that's foreign Islam, that's Wahhabism, or that's Iranian Islam. And they would talk about the Senegalese model as a tolerant, peaceful Islam that is, you know, open to diversity, pluralism, and not a single way of interpreting the faith. And obviously, I would say that you know, connects with a pluralistic, open, tolerant political system as well.
Now, you mentioned that Sufi Islam or the Sufi brotherhoods are the predominant flavor of Islam there. How does Sufism differ than, say, Wahhabism or the typical Islam that you might find in Iraq or even perhaps Iran, Shiitism?
Well, Sufi Islam is usually centered around a personal relationship between the Sufi master and his. It's usually his, although there are some women, female, in some traditions, female masters, but the master and his disciples. And he is seen as sort of the priestly knowledgeable figure that offers advice and is the middle man or the middle person between the individual and the and Allah or God. Many of these Sufi brotherhoods have memberships in the thousands. They are decentralized in the sense that you have, obviously, in each village will have its own Sufi master who may represent a particular Sufi tradition. But by and large, the Sufis tend to be more mystical. They engage in practices such as saint worship, which Orthodox Sunni Muslims, would, particularly the Wahhabis, would consider heretical. And by and large, many of them have incorporated, again, these local pre-Islamic traditions into their practices, including, you know, local saint worship of ancestors that predate Islam. And they tend to be, not all, but many of them tend to be less focused upon, you know, textual literalism and more into Islam as a way of life and understanding, you know, spiritual understanding, and don't get involved politically as much as some of the movements we see elsewhere in the Muslim world.
So one of the things that I noticed here in relationship with Turkey as well is that democratization comes before the insertion of political Islam, and that seems to be a, at least these two cases, that seems to be a beneficial aspect of creating democracy here. Let's get the democratic political systems down and then worry about Islam a little bit later. Are there any lessons that the rest of the Muslim world could learn from either Turkey or from Senegal?
Well, I think, and maybe we'll get to it later, I think one of the interesting things that I write about in the book, and it was something that I did not necessarily expect, because again, I'm not coming at it as a scholar of religion, but reading about and learning about these cases, one thing that really strikes me in all the cases that have been more successful is that nations craft their own type of Islam, where they'll say, we are as Muslim, but we have Turkish Islam, and we do things a little bit differently, or we have Senegalese Islam, or we have Indonesian Islam, and we have to recognize the local context, our local history, And usually these countries will juxtapose or contrast their Muslim, their Islam with Arab Islam or Middle Eastern Islam. What you've seen, and just jumping ahead a little bit, again, I just doing reading on this, for example, in Tunisia, which is, I would say, successfully democratizing. It's still early, but certainly they've cleared several hurdles already. They've written a new constitution, had new elections. The Tunisians are revisiting their Islam and trying to reanimate traditions going back a couple hundred years to say, wait a second, we have a unique Tunisian Islam, and we have to be sensitive to our own, you know, local context. You know, we're more secular oriented, we're more, you know, European oriented, we're more influenced by the West, whatever, what have you, right? That I think allows you to open up the idea that there are multiple Islams, and that there, even if there's a single Quran or a single collection of hadiths or sunnah or whatever, that there are multiple interpretations. And I think that allowance for pluralism and recognizing that there's more than one way of doing anything is the first step on the way to democracy, because then you can say, well, now we can debate aspects of freedom of speech, or we can have different political parties because we're representing different interpretations of certain things. So I would say that's an important thing, that if you're trying to design a democracy, that's something you would want to try to do.
So Senegal was a pretty successful case, and Tunisia is looking pretty good too. There's another case that you deal with in Africa that you call the least likely case to democratize, and that is Mali. And again, a lot of people might not know where Mali is. I had to go look it up on the map. So tell us a little bit about Mali and why it is considered the least likely case, and how's it turned out?
Well, I think Mali is a really fascinating case, and I mention it in my classes a lot because it really is the exception among all exceptions. If you had to pick a country in the world based upon what we know about fosters democracy, I don't think you would pick Mali at all. It's in northwest Africa. The northern half of the country is essentially inhospitable desert, the Sahara. It's mostly the southern half of the country that's populated. In the year it democratized in 1992, when it first had free and fair elections, it had democratized in the wake of a military coup. It had no prior democratic experience whatsoever. It ranked 155 out of 160 on the UN Human Development Index, with an average GDP per capita of just over $500 a year, 32% literacy rate, and I couldn't believe this, but according to the UN, 0.3 years as the average years of schooling for the typical Malian in 1992. I mean, society wasn't educated, it was poor, it's landlocked, it has no real substantial resources, no substantial trading partners, and no substantial democratic experience at all. But it has managed to sustain a democracy, competitive elections, a vibrant civil society, changes in government from 1992 until there was a coup in 2012. The coup was precipitated mostly because the military got frustrated with the government's inability to deal with separatists in the north and a threat from Islamic militants, Al-Qaeda, based in the north. They overthrew the government, but they've since reestablished elections. It's not officially democratic yet as measured by Polity or Freedom House, but it seems to be back on that trajectory. So again, here you have another poor country in Africa, overwhelmingly Muslim, that has managed to democratize. Most Malians are not members of the Sufi sect, as they are in Senegal, although there is a substantial history of Sufism in Mali. But what's interesting in Mali, again, is that they draw upon this constructed or recreated history of previous empires, particularly the Malayan Empire dating back to the 1400s, to show that we were multi-ethnic, we were multi-confessional, we were tolerant, we didn't impose Islam upon the entire population in some sort of dogmatic way. It sort of, you know, evolved organically. They built upon the French secular model, was another French colony. And given that history and given elites that are committed, have been committed since 1992 to democracy, and they've been supported as well by outside actors. A lot of foreign aid has come into Mali because it's seen as this democratic success. It's done remarkably well, especially given the handicaps that it has.
the word tolerance keeps coming up in all these cases, and that seems to be a critical factor here, is that not only is there tolerance for Islam, but there's tolerance for seculars. So seculars have to tolerate the religious folks, and the religious folks have to tolerate the seculars. And so that seems right. to be a theme. Yeah. And fostering
right.
that.
That's the twin tolerations. Al Stepan, I don't know if you've had him on your program, but he writes about that.
We have tried to get him on. Yeah, we have tried to get him on his program, but he has not come on yet. So we're working on it. So the twin tolerations of that, it seems to be working in these different cases. With one question with Molly, you mentioned the 2012 coup, that basically there was a kind of a big shakeup in northern Africa with the fall of Gaddafi and with the beginning of the Arab Spring, changed a lot of political dynamics here. It seems that that coup was precipitated by a great deal of concern over the possible imposition of Islam in certain areas. And I know Mali was facing a breakaway group. I think it's the Tuaregs, if I was correct.
Tuaregs, uh-huh.
Yeah. And is that the thing that the military was really worried about, the perhaps ending of this tolerance?
I don't know if I could go quite, perhaps. I think they were concerned that the government had been ineffective in dealing with the militant threats in the north, and figured that they would take over to restore order and, you know, reorganize their forces. Certainly the military was anti-Al-Qaeda, and certainly many Malians had fled from the north when they took over cities like Timbuktu, fled from the south, and there was a lot of concern about the imposition of harsh Islamic law in the north and a reaction against that. Again, that's not how we do things here. So, I think it's fair to say that the secular or at least the more moderate Malayans, you know, viewed this as a grave threat. In fact, as I've quoted in the book, the leading Islamic preacher in Mali, who's well known, he fills soccer stadiums or whatnot when he speaks, and he's on record as saying, "I don't know what this is in the north. You know, this is not our Islam. You know, this is a strange faith to us. This is not the way how we do things." And so the coup did. You know, usually people concerned about democracy will say, you know, military coup is bad. Well, in all evidence suggests, in Mali anyway, the military coup in 2012 had substantial public support. And by 2013, within a year and a half, they went back and had competitive elections again. So it's not like the military, you know, wanted to come into power and stay in power, as you might see in other African countries.
Now, we've talked about a couple very successful cases here, and that is very heartening. There's been some cases that have some struggles. And one of those cases that you bring up in the book, again, it's not a country that a lot of people would associate with Islam per se, and that is Bangladesh. Tell us, what is happening with Bangladesh and their struggles with democracy and political Islam?
Well, Bangladesh is, along with Pakistan and Malaysia, are countries that I would code as having some democratic experience, but not quite as successful. Bangladesh became independent in 1971 after fighting a war of independence against Pakistan. Bangladesh, prior to this, had been known as East Pakistan. It fought a war against West Pakistan, which now we just know as Pakistan. And when Bangladesh fought its war, it did so in part because people in Bengal, the people in what is now Bangladesh, were concerned about creeping Islamization from West Pakistan and the dominance of West Pakistani views on the country. And the Bengalis have crafted as well a sort of syncretic mixture of Islam that draws upon, in some cases, Hindu beliefs, but also local traditions. Again, their own type of Bengali Islam that they think represents them better. So they declared themselves a secular country when they became independent in 1971, but were ruled by military figures, military generals who sought to modernize and stabilize and establish Bangladesh. But starting in the 1980s, you saw movement to Islamicize the country. Islam was adopted as the official religion, so secularism ended. And so you had repression in Bangladesh. But because of mismanagement, corruption, a failing economy, in the 1990s you saw movement for political change. Elections were held, and the country democratized in 1990. And it's sort of alternated in power since the 1990s between two leaders, both of whom, one's the daughter and one's the widow of former Bangladeshi political figures. So you have two female leaders in Bangladesh who have alternated in power since the 1990s. But the country really never has, it reestablished secularism, but it never has really fully democratized in sense of gaining, you know, full political rights and liberties. Its democracy score remains mediocre, and it's gone through ups and downs where the military has stepped in or the government has declared emergency law to repress political rights. And right now, Bangladesh is really suffering from two main ills. One is the rivalry between these two leaders. One leader is you know, under house arrest, and the elections in 2014 were boycotted by the opposition party. So you really, it's difficult to claim Bangladesh is a democracy today. And the second problem in Bangladesh is terrorism, violence in the country, whether it be bombings, whether it be, you know, beheadings or machete attacks on people in broad daylight in some cases who are seen as not sufficiently Muslim enough or too Western in their orientation or what have you. So you're seeing a lot of political instability there. And people are writing about, you know, concerns about Bangladesh becoming the next base for Al-Qaeda or turning into, you know, another Afghanistan or something. That may be taking it too far. But it's clear that democracy has not been a panacea for the country. It remains poor. It remains deeply polarized between these two groups. And political Islam now, I would say, more so even than in the 1980s, has taken on a ability to mobilize people on the streets, has come out in a violent sort of way, and has really cast a shadow across Bangladeshi politics that makes real open, honest debate on many questions quite difficult.
That brings me to one of the last chapters in your book. You talk about the spread of political Islam from other countries. You talked about creeping Islamization across borders and such. A few years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago or so, back in 2011, there was a glimmer of hope known as the Arab Spring, starting in Tunisia and washing all across northern Africa and into Egypt and to some parts of the Middle East. There's this hope that, the region is changing, that there is going to be greater democracy. And that might not have borne as much fruit as many people hoped. And you talk about this in the last part of your book. It might be something that Bangladesh is dealing with at times here as well. Give us your interpretation of the Arab Spring. Where has it gone, and what impacts do you think this might have on the future of democracy in the Muslim world?
Well, I think, again, I was cautiously optimistic about the Arab Spring, and I think we can really only talk about one success story out of that, and that's Tunisia. Elsewhere, what you've seen, whether it be in Egypt, whether it be in Libya, Syria, Yemen, Bahrain, you've seen the Arab Spring was uprising against dictatorships. But it was often a motley coalition or inchoate group of groups that mobilized against what they knew what they were against, but it was unclear what they were for. And since then, you've seen political Islam, Islamist groups come to the fore in many countries, seeking to use this moment of change to implement to put Islam at the forefront of the politics in these countries, to enshrine it in the Constitution, to adopt Islamic law, that is the basis of the state, and their interpretation of Islam will prevail. Now, in some cases, like in Libya or Yemen, perhaps there's also tribalism that's on top of this. So it's not only Islam. I'm thinking more perhaps maybe of the Egyptian case. And this obviously was threatening to many, and in the Egyptian case, you saw the Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood removed from power in a military coup, which was supported by many Egyptians, seeing this as necessary because of the threats represented by the Muslim Brotherhood. In Tunisia, I think you have a really interesting and positive example, and one can hope that it will continue to succeed, where a Islamic-oriented political party became the leading party in Tunisia, but it did not have a majority. I think that's key, right? It could not impose its will and write a constitution by itself. It had to work with its opponents, who, by and large, were secular in orientation. Tunisia also has a tradition of labor activism and social democracy and, you know, parties on the political left. These groups had to work together, and they managed to do so, and they finessed certain questions. Women's rights were upheld after there were protests in Tunisia to make sure women's rights would be protected in the constitution. Islam is the official religion, nominally, but Islamic law is not adopted, and there are provisions for, you know, non-Muslims that their rights will be respected. And you had the constitution that was adopted there, and that was successful. And then you saw in 2014, Tunisia had free elections, and the Islamic-oriented party, Ennahda, was defeated. And now you have secularists who have taken over the Tunisian government. Now, you know, obviously, with last week's attack in Tunisia and the attack in the museum in Tunisia as well, there's still problems of terrorism and instability in Tunisia, and there's a whole host of economic problems there. But at least I think they've got the politics right, the institutional design right, and the elections are producing moderates and parties who are willing to work together and respect electoral results. That's not true elsewhere, obviously. Compromise is difficult. If you're dogmatic in your religion or your allegiance to a particular tribe or what have you, democracy is probably not for you because you believe you are right with a capital R and everybody else is wrong with a capital W. And that's not going to produce a successful give-and-take democracy. So I remain cautiously optimistic about Tunisia. Again, a country also that's, you know, a middle-income country. The European Union's a strong influence there as well. Perhaps looking more broadly, one could say there are movements for political change in countries like Morocco. Again, where the European Union and a, you know, moderate-income country where, you know, political Islamic-oriented parties seem to be willing to work towards political reforms. Perhaps in Jordan. But elsewhere, it's in Iraqi Kurdistan. But elsewhere, I would say it's really hard to be an optimist about this, at least in the Middle East.
Well, it's something that we're going to have to be watching as time goes on. You provided us a great comparative perspective on things here, glimmers of optimism, but also shades of concern. My guest today has been Paul Kubicek. Paul, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
My pleasure, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.